is Dr. Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the American Counseling Association's 2015 podcast series. Today we are speaking with Dr. Dana Heller-Levitt and Dr. Holly J. Hartwick-Moorhead about values and ethics in counseling. Dr. Dana Heller-Levitt is an associate professor in the counseling program at Montclair State University. She is a member of the KCREP Board of Directors and a past member of the ACA Ethics Committee. She serves on the editorial board for Counseling and Values and has published in this and other ACA publications on ethics and counselor development. She is the co-author of Values and Ethics in Counseling, Real Life Ethical Decision Making with Dr. Moorhead. Dr. Levitt has been a counselor educator for over 14 years, having developed and taught ethics courses at two institutions. Her work with Dr. Moorhead highlights her teaching and research emphases on the roles and values in ethical decision-making and ethical counselor practice. Dr. Holly J. Hartwick-Moorhead is an associate professor in the School of Psychology and Counseling at Regent University. Additionally, Holly serves as a member of the American Counseling Association's Ethics Committee, the Association for Spiritual, Ethical, and Religious Values in Counseling Board of Directors, and the Editorial Board for the Counseling and Values Journal. Among other professional service involvement, she previously was the Ethics Officer for the National Board for Certified Counselors and chaired the Ethics Committee for a State Counseling Association. With Dr. Dana Levitt, she is the author of Values and Ethics in Counseling, Real Life Ethical Decision Making, published by Routledge. Welcome, Dana and Holly.
Thanks so much for having us.
All right. Dana, the first question is for you. Tell us about why you wrote Values and Ethics in Counseling, Real Life Ethical Decision Making.
Sure. So Holly and I were fortunate enough to be thrown together through some professional association work several years ago, and we started having some conversations about what we were seeing about how counselors are being prepared to address ethical issues in practice. And what we noticed in the literature, and as we spoke with counselors and as we spoke with students, as counselor educators ourselves, we saw that there was really a hole in the literature and in practice about the role of values in ethical decision making. From our own experiences as counselors and then as counselor educators as well, we kept seeing that there's a personal stance that's involved in ethical decision making. What we really wanted to do is we wanted to take the book that we did produce and really start to implement and really emphasize just how important it is that we come to ethical challenges as people and that our values really inform the kind of work that we do. We also, as a bit of self-disclosure, Holly and I share some feminist leanings, and we really started to wonder about the notion of the person in context as that relates to counseling and also as that relates to ethical decision-making and counseling more specifically. So with the book, we wanted to hear stories. We wanted to hear from practicing counselors about how they really handled ethical decisions in practice. How did they really work through some of the models that we spend a lot of time in counselor preparation programs preparing them to use, and really utilize the book as an extension of what we often do, what Holly and I have discussed that we both separately do as counselor educators, is to really try to suspend time when we're faced with an ethical challenge and really deconstruct it, but really starting with it from the standpoint of what's going on for me, what are my values, what's kind of nagging at me as I'm faced with this challenging case, in ways that we don't often have the luxury of doing when we're faced with these challenges in practice, to really help counselors at any point in their careers to begin to examine that not only do they have personal reactions to situations that are out there, but to read about how professional counselors at any point along the professional spectrum take values into account as they're dealing with these challenges.
Holly, what is unique about the focus on values in the book?
Well, as Dana mentioned, we saw that values were a significant part of counselor ethical decision making in our work as counselor educators teaching students, teaching ethics, whether we're supervising counselors in our own clinical work, and then, of course, being part of professional counseling organization ethics committees and adjudication processes. We were seeing that counselors really do consider values in their ethical decision-making processes, is part of, and in some cases even more than, working through standardized ethical decision-making models. But sometimes there's a tendency for counselors not to recognize how much their values impact their ethical decision-making. And perhaps both, sometimes we saw that there was a fear that counselors felt they shouldn't admit or talk about the reality that their values really do play a part in ethical decision-making. And so we wanted to provide a way for counselors to reflect upon how their values really do play a role in how they make ethical decisions in real-life practice without requiring necessarily a politically correct filter. And we also wanted counselors, we wanted to hear from counselors with various levels of experience, from very new counselors to counselors who had many years of clinical experience, and to have them talk about how their values play a role in how they make ethical decisions in using these standardized models, and also, as Dana said, sort of suspending time and looking at how those values were present and whether they paid attention to them, whether they didn't. And so in our book, you'll find real-world ethical dilemmas that real counselors faced and how they looked at those values, how they recognized them, and how they thought about those in the context of making decisions that were best for the client, which, of course, is our foremost ethical responsibility. And we tried to step away from just looking at ethical decision-making as a linear step-by-step process, but recognize that the values that are present and then look at how those values colored an approach to ethical decision-making, even with a step-by-step model. So you'll see in the cases that we talk about, counselors' values sometimes were managed in a way that facilitated an effective ethical response, and in other cases you see that counselor values may not have been addressed as effectively as they could have been for the ethical decisions that were reached. But either way, you really get a candid glimpse into counselors' values as they grapple with these ethical issues that are really complex and that come up with every client just about in supervisees, for those of us who supervise, and how those values that we live with every day really play out in these real-world decisions.
You know, I used to be sitting with a client, and I would be aware of the fact that something they said I didn't like, I personally didn't like, and I would say to myself, this isn't about you, Rebecca, this is about the client, and that would kind of make me refocus and not be so judgmental about the thing that was said. I wonder if that's kind of a common practice. What do you think?
Yes, I think so. And I think that goes back to what we were talking about in reference before. I think the ability for you to do that, certainly I've done that with clients too. Somewhere in our training, we probably had a supervisor, an instructor. We were in a process that encouraged us to be able to take that step back and to think about, to value our value, but not to have to impose it in that moment for it to be meaningful. And I think that's a challenge that I have observed with counselors who are wrestling with how do my values play into this process with a client in an ethically appropriate way.
Yeah. Dana, in your book you write about morals, values, and ethics. What's the intersection of the three?
Yeah, you know, that was something that took us a little bit of time to deconstruct ourselves. You know, what we're really looking at is, and we do, we try to define the three concepts separately for our readers. You know, we look at morals as that foundational personal belief system. And so when you take your roots back to Lawrence Kohlberg and to Carol Gilligan's work, you can really see that morality and morals are at the foundation of what we believe. When we talk about values, we talk about sort of the action that we put on those personal belief systems. So, you know, so one's morals about, you know, if we take it at its most basic level, is that it's wrong to hurt other people. And that serves as a foundation. And the values are, wait a minute, but now I see somebody who's hurting somebody else, and maybe, you know, in the world of counseling, it's not quite as black and white as that, is that maybe somebody's hurting somebody else through actions that are bullying or words that they might be saying to a partner that are less than supportive. And that taps into that personal belief system of it's wrong to hurt other people, and really starts to have more of an action orientation to it. The ethics piece is the professional component of it. And so what we see in the approach that we take, the intersection that we take, is that the ethics is how our own personal belief systems, how those morals and how we act on those, how those values appear in our professional work. So when we take the case of, of working with a client or a student who's in a bullying situation, our personal beliefs and our values are inevitably intertwined in the work that we're doing. It may not always be conscientious. We may not be able to, as the example that you just gave, it's a developmental process for counselors to be able to take a step back and say, wait a minute, this is about where I believe and what I believe is best for the client versus what the client believes is best for him or herself. So we may not always know that they are intertwined, but they're always part of the work that we do. I think about some of the cases that we have from some of the contributors to our book where they were able to kind of work backwards in some ways. So they knew what their ethical responsibilities were, yet there was something sort of personal that didn't seem to feel quite right about how to handle those professional responsibilities, given the fact that there's an individual, there's a person sitting in front of them. And so this is really that piece, that big circle that we talk about in the book, is this notion that, we know that there's a code of ethics that we're supposed to follow, and we know what each section of the code guides us to do, and we will do that. It's the how that we get there that really is the big piece of bringing our morals and our values into the ethical picture.
Holly, there's been a lot of focus on how counselor values should be addressed in understanding ethics and practicing ethically. Counselors listening to this podcast may think that they have to check their values at the door. Is that even possible?
I think that a lot of people are wondering about this question. And, Dana and I take the position that counselors ultimately have an obligation to maintain professionalism, and that is abiding by ethical standards and utilizing evidence-based practice and those things that are part of who we are as professional counselors. But we also recognize that, as Dana mentioned before, counselors are people, and people have values. That's part of, I think, the heart of counseling. We're not machines devoid of personal histories and idiosyncratic perspectives. We have them, and so we believe that our client's well-being is not protected when counselors deny that they have personal values or sort of blindly state that their values absolutely don't enter into the counselor-client relationship. Indeed, the literature tells us that both clients and counselors bring values to the counseling relationship. So the answer isn't for counselors to deny the presence and the influence of their values, but we believe that instead the answer is for counselors to recognize what their values are and what their clients' values are. And then, as Dana mentioned, it's that process, carefully examine how these values affect the counselor's ethical decision-making process. And so that, we believe, really requires us as a profession to value and intentionally create safe spaces for counselors to do this work. And as Dana mentioned before, that takes time to learn. And I think to your question before, learning how in that moment when you're with a client and you realize there's a values issue at play, to have that internal process and practice, if you will, at recognizing what's happening, but then being able to ethically respond in that moment to act in the client's well-being, which is our foremost ethical obligation.
It reminded me of, I was reading a case book recently of just different cases and how somebody dealt with it. And in one of the cases, she said, and this woman who was a counselor and identified herself as a feminist, she said that she had a client who came in and said that her husband made her scrub the floor if they got in a fight. And so all of us who, you know, who at least are partially a feminist, if not completely a feminist, would just cringe. I mean, what are you talking about? This, you, your husband has told you you have to scrub the floor because you disagreed with him. It's just, so anyway, she said that how she dealt with it is to basically say to the client, how do you feel when he makes you scrub the floor because you disagree with him? And as opposed to, you know, coming out with all she was feeling. Do you want to comment on that?
Sure. I'll comment, and then I'll ask Dana if she wants to as well. I think what you just described is the very heart of recognizing a values conflict. And not just recognizing it, but honoring it. I think... that as people, we don't always have to agree, but as counselors, what we do professionally is create space for for people to interact in respectful ways. And our job, going back to the very first point that I made when you asked me the first question, was that we're professionals in that relationship. So it isn't about us. It isn't about our value. It's about recognizing we're having a reaction, but making that appropriate for the client. What is the meaning the client puts with that? And how do we help the client, through her worldview and her values, make sense of this in a in a way that promotes her well-being? Those are my thoughts initially. Dana, you may have a thought too.
Sure. I mean, Holly, I think you said it really well, and one of the words that I've often heard Holly say as we worked on this project and throughout and beyond is this idea of honoring. And so it's honoring the client and honoring the client's space. And from a counselor preparation perspective also, it's really honoring for the individual counselor his or her own values and that they do exist and that they are part of it. There's a metaphor that I use with students and supervisees, and that's of, and sometimes it's not even a metaphor, it's an actual, a glass jar. So imagine that you have a glass jar with you when you're in session with your clients, and your client says something that sort of hits you with a visceral reaction. Perhaps it's not quite so strong, but it's something taking the example that you just gave us, Rebecca, you know, and Holly and I self-disclose for both of us that, you know, we operate from a feminist perspective as counselors, as individuals, as women. And so certainly I had a reaction in hearing you describe this case. But what's important for me to do is to recognize that I have a value and something is something I'm responding to. I can take that value and I can put it in this glass jar and put the top on tightly. I can see that jar. I can see that that value exists for me when I'm in session and know that it's something that I want to pay attention to when I come out of session and what I want to pay attention to in terms of my own growth and my own recognition about how do I manage when I'm hearing something that is at odds with or perhaps resonates with what my client is saying and what I might believe and how I act upon those personal belief systems. So, you know, moving to that point of being able to ask the question of, so how does it feel for you? Is really, it's aspirational. That's what we're aiming towards. I think sometimes as counselors, we need a little bit of prompting and we may need some of those either actual or imaginary prompts to help us to go through that process to remind us that this isn't about us. This is about the client and this is our professional responsibility.
I love that metaphor of the glass jar. That's fabulous. Dana, there have been a few recent court cases that focus on values-based counselor referrals. How can counselors manage their values if referral is not an option or not encouraged?
This is really tricky, and it's something that really has been in the forefront of the professional literature and professional discussions for the last couple of years. So the two cases that are most prevalent are the Ward v. Wilbanks and Keaton versus Anderson-Wiley. And they really highlighted what those challenges are in terms of an individual counseling student identifying a set of personal values, and with that set of personal values, making a determination that there are certain individuals, certain clients with certain characteristics with whom they are not able to work. What the case is really established is that it's not permissible, that it's discrimination, and that there are other related issues to that. And so we've seen the discussion in our professional journals, and you know, even through Counseling Today, some of the discussion has unfolded. And we look at you know, certainly at the way that our 2014 Code of Ethics read, really to make much more clear that making a referral because your values are at odds is really not an option, because it's not professionally appropriate, and it's not professionally responsible and personally respectful of the individual. So, you know, the way that, I've looked at this, and it's been interesting to have been writing this book at the time that these cases were becoming more and more prevalent. This was a venture that Holly and I started before these cases were in the spotlight. You know, really kind of looking at what we've written in the book and looking at how the cases unfolded is that, you know, we really think that these are examples of where students could have benefited from some of the self-reflective processes that we discuss and we describe. And you know, certainly as you look at the book and the cases that we've asked people to write about and to write about their reactions, we've done the same. We've given some of our analyses, and part of that is really encouraging some of these personal self-reflective questions to oneself. So really looking at that values exploration to really see what's at issue. I think it goes back to what Holly was talking about managing those personal values and managing them in such a way that we're able to look at what's underneath, what's the real struggle that's there. You know, the one other piece that I do want to share is that about a year ago, so I believe it was in the April 2014 Journal of Counseling and Development, Michael Kosett and Barbara Herlihy presented an article looking at their counselor value-based conflict model. This is a model that makes a lot of sense when we're thinking about the idea of value-based referrals and the fact that that's not a reason for a referral. And what Kosett and Herlihy do is they walk counselors through this process of delineating what's a personal value, what's a professional value, what are the conflicts that are at odds, and what are the conflicts that can be resolved. Looking at this really as knowing that referral isn't an easy out. In previous previous issues of the Code of Ethics, and certainly as some counselors of other generations were prepared, you know, we were often prepared that, you know, if you feel like you can't work with somebody, then make a referral. Well, it's not really an option. First of all, it's not always an option. I mean, you may be working someplace where you're the only counselor, or, you know, your client may only have access to you. But also looking at it more from the human struggle perspective of it is that, okay, so I don't agree with this person's, beliefs about, about relationships, but I can certainly respect that here's somebody sitting in front of me who's struggling and who's dealing with something that hits at the core of challenges to how to operate within a professional framework or how to operate in school, and really trying to look at it at more of a base level than looking at the presenting issue per se. It seems a little simplistic, but I think it kind of encourages us to really shift our focus to focusing and respecting human struggle versus trying to say that this value doesn't agree with my own value.
Holly, when we think about Ward versus Wilbanks and other cases, when is it ethically appropriate to refer a client, and what is the process of ethically referring a client?
Well, I think tagging on to what Dana shared just a few minutes ago, that the ACA Code of Ethics makes it very clear that counselors need to be aware of their own values, and it is unethical for a counselor to impose her own values or his own values on a client. And the 2014 Code of Ethics also makes it very clear that and counselor cannot just refer a client simply because of a values conflict with a client. And mm-hmm. that's a difficult question. When is it a values conflict, and when is it a competence issue? And so what we try to talk about, certainly in our own counseling practice and our work with students in supervision, to highlight the fact that counselors have an ethical obligation to ensure that they have pursued appropriate training to be able to work with a variety of issues and people and values conflicts, going back to what we've talked about in the last few minutes, recognizing that we have values, mm-hmm. counselors have them, clients have them, but how do we suspend those when we're working with a client to work in the best interest of a client? And so we recommend that supervision and consultation, which are always part of any of the ethical decision-making models you're looking at within the counseling profession, those are really core activities and core values, if you will, of an appropriate process. And for counselors to not just do this in isolation, but to look at critically themselves and their practice, what is a values issue and what's a competence issue? And if there's a competence issue, if there's a values issue, the impetus is on us to pursue training, education, additional experiences to be able to deal with that as counselors before we work with clients, and not just sort of put out a statement that we don't work with this, we don't work with that, we don't work with
right.
this, we don't work with that.
Right.
As Dana mentioned, there are a variety of reasons why clients mm-hmm. may need a counselor in a community, and for us to be able to work with the competently with the most amount of people who need mental health services in various forms, that's our ethical obligation. And so when there is an issue of competence, though, the Code of Ethics is very clear that there's a process that needs to unfold. It's not just, I can't work with you, good luck.
Right,
we
right.
work with clients to find appropriate referrals, appropriate resources for them that mm-hmm. take into account whether it's cultural issues or clinical issues, and we also take that step to appropriately help clients connect to those resources. And that's going to look different for different clients, mm-hmm. I think, but it's not just handing them a piece of paper and saying good luck. It's helping them in a real way connect to those resources so that there isn't an issue of abandonment. And really we are referring in the best interest of the client, not just for the counselor's comfort.
Right, right. Dana, many counselors might be afraid to talk about their own values and how they impact their work, especially their ethical decision-making. Can you speak to ethical decision-making models and how values are a part of the process?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, certainly Holly and I take the bias that they're integral to mm-hmm. the ethical decision-making process. You know, and I think what Holly has said early on in our discussion here today is reminding counselors that we're human, and mm-hmm. the reason that some clients may fit better with some counselors than with others is because we're human, and it's what we bring to the relationship and the values that come with it. You know, the ethical decision-making models, some of the earliest ones have this, you know, if you look at some of the linear models and the seven-step process, early on in those steps is this notion of tuning into your feelings and, you know, identifying mm-hmm. the moral principles that may be at play. So really they are part of the models, the values are part of the models that are there. I think it's sometimes the translation of the models into practice is where the values can get lost. So, you know, we really highlight the importance of helping counselors to talk about their values and to do that in supervision. And again, as we've said, regardless of where you are in your development as a counselor, if you're just starting out, if you're a student, or if you've been a counselor for 20 years, I have a good friend who was in private practice for 25 years and had a weekly peer supervision group. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of what they talked about is what are you responding to in your with your clients? And so it's part of having the discussion about values really can be a preventative approach. I think if you look at decision-making models more intentionally and look at how values play in there, one of the approaches that might be helpful is to certainly look at the principal ethics, so looking at autonomy and beneficence and non-maleficence, and those mm-hmm. are certainly, they're foundational to the work that we do. The other body of ethics that sometimes we don't pay as much attention to are the virtue ethics. And the virtue ethics really answer that question of what kind of a counselor do I want to be versus the principal ethics, which say, what do I do? And often when we're faced with ethical challenges, our initial reaction is, what do I do? What I think is that sometimes we need to take a step back and say, wait a minute, what's the integrity here? How do I discern right from wrong? What's in mm-hmm. the best interest of my client? How am I tapping into my own belief systems here? So I think that those are important ways that we can really allow values to be part of that decision-making process. The two other pieces I want to say with that. One is that, again, I think that I would refer our listeners to our reference list, and certainly you'll find the Kosit and Herlihy counselor value-based conflict model, because I think that they really have done what some of the models have not as intentionally done, is to really put values back into the process. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that's a really good reading to learn a little bit more about it. The other point that I want to just make about the values in the ethical decision-making models is just to remind everybody that they take time and that, they are really good teaching tools and they're good supervision tools to encourage counselors in training and counselor educators and supervisors to really walk through the models and to be intentional about walking through the models and to spend time when there's that opportunity to do that, so that we can more intentionally see where values are coming into play and how they can be more readily be considered in our work that we're doing.
And I want to tell our listeners that a lot of the things that we're referring to during this podcast will be on a link at the bottom of the podcast write-up. Okay. Holly, counselor values seem to be so much about identity. How do we actually encourage counselors to bring themselves into the counseling relationship without imposing their values? What a hard question, but Holly, please take a stab at that one.
Well, this is a hard one, but we'll do our best here. I think as we've been talking about over the last several minutes, I think what draws people to be counselors is that connection, a person reaching another person. The reason clients come to counselors is because they need a person to help them in their journey. And research certainly tells us that one of the most important therapeutic factors in the counselor-client relationship is rapport, a client feeling connected and understood and heard by the counselor. And so this really shows us, it tells us how important it is for counselors to show up, to be authentic, to be sincere, and really to be themselves when they work with clients. Again, with the important caveat that we are the professional in the relationship. So we have extra guidelines and standards that we need to meet within that professional context. But this part of bringing ourselves and who we are as people into the counselor-client relationship is part of that therapeutic important factor. But I think that in terms of bringing that professional self but in that authentic, real self to the counselor-client relationship means that as counselors, we really have to have a working knowledge, not just a cerebral understanding of the ethical standards that apply to our practice, as well as the reasons for why these standards are in place. What Dana talked about, I think, in her last response, understanding that these ethical standards aren't just a do this, don't do that. There are aspirational elements to these things as much as there are these mandatory should and shouldn'ts.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that really requires us to seek out and then fully engage in. We have to be willing to engage in quality training, and that extends beyond graduate school or a counseling degree. That is part of what we do as counselors in supervision, and I think there's an important distinction there, qualified supervision, qualified consultation, and seeking out quality professional development so we continue to learn about ourselves, not just about clients, but also ourselves. We know that counselor development is a developmental process. Just as our clients change and grow, we do too. And as we're monitoring and understanding our values, we have to be looking at ourselves. And I think, you know, there's many of us would say too, some of our values perhaps have changed. Mm-hmm. Some of them remain the same, but nuances of them change over time. And if we don't pay attention to those, I think that can be a very slippery slope for us as we try to navigate this ethical boundary with clients addressing values. And quality ethical decision-making doesn't come from just reading an ethics textbook, although we think our book is great. But that's not going to make anybody work with values confidently. And so if it as a dynamic, kind of constantly evolving process, we encourage ourselves and our colleagues to be willing to look at people and situations in new and different ways. And that comes from that supervision, consultation, engaging in continuing ed that really pushes us and allows us to give feedback and also receive feedback. And I think that also requires an awareness from each and every one of us that we have to be intentional about recognizing potential and actual ethical issues and deliberately working through those. As Dana mentioned, even as we're working sort of with a standardized model, giving time and space, not just to think about checking the boxes, but what are my reactions to this? What are the values that are surfacing for me and the client? And how are those then affecting the decisions that I'm making? And are those in the ultimate well-being of the client? And all of that to say that I think most of all, this process requires us as counselors to remember that counseling really isn't about us. It's about the clients we serve and being sure that we work from that perspective first and foremost.
Yeah, you know, it seems like in every podcast, Rogers comes up. And as you were talking, I was thinking about meeting your client where they are. And it's just so important. But to meet the client where they are requires you, too. So, it's, you know, you have to be looking at your values and admitting when your values are changing, don't you think?
I do. And I think that, you know, just as In the counseling profession, we have seen an understanding of the importance of spiritual and religious values change over time where, you know, once upon a time, we don't really talk about that. That's not appropriate for this particular milieu. And now we recognize that's such a central part of wellness, of culture, of understanding how somebody interacts with the world. Values in who we are as counselors, I think, is having sort of an evolution, too. We're not just a blank slate. A client isn't talking to a blank wall. They're talking to a person. And so just as folks in other professions maybe use a hammer or a wrench or a different tool, we are our tools. And so we have to keep ourselves in tune. And and we have to do some upkeep in order to be able to appropriately and ethically serve and give in this dynamic process where we're authentic and we also have a professional self that we bring to this dynamic.
You know, and I think that if I can just add to that, I think the dynamic process is really critical also, because although our focus is on our clients, as counselors, we learn a lot from our clients, too, and we learn a lot about how they manage the world, which helps us to expand our own worldview as well. And, you know, maybe not bringing – it would not be appropriate to bring in, so, you know, help me understand what that looks like, because here's my worldview on things. But really being able to, as Holly said, be able to recognize how we as counselors are influenced by what we're hearing from the people with whom we work – helps us to identify when our own values may be shifting.
Yeah, and I agree. I always say my clients taught me everything I know about counseling. And it's really true. If you're open and you're open to a lesson, you know, you can get a lot from your a lot of those lessons from your clients. Dana, how do counselors know when their values are inappropriately involved in their professional ethical decision making?
Yeah. You know, it's that adage of if something doesn't feel right, it probably isn't.
Right.
And I think that really requires so much of that self-reflective practice that we've talked about. You know, some early writers around ethics and ethical decision-making talked about moral traces, that if we have walked through an ethical dilemma using a linear model or not using a model, and something doesn't feel right after the fact and there are these moral traces, then probably something isn't quite right. Oftentimes what we found, and there are a couple of cases that stand out to me in particular, is that a lot of times it's an after the fact. It's sort of this post hoc, maybe my values were leading me a little bit more. Fortunately, in most cases where that happens, there's an opportunity to follow up with a client and to be able to recover a little bit. For example, one of the cases in our books, one of our contributors writes about seeing a client at a party. And then what that does in terms of the personal and professional boundaries and being able to, after the fact, speak with a supervisor and say, so here's how I handle things at the party, and the supervisor and the client, the counselor together being able to say, yeah, that's probably not going to be the best way for your counseling relationship to proceed. There's another case that I'm thinking of where one of our contributors writes about some visceral reactions she was having when she was learning about some intricacies with some infidelity in some couples counseling. As she was doing, and really being able to tune in, and we so appreciated, you know, her honesty in responding to that, in seeing that, you know, as something was unfolding, she could feel herself responding to it and saying that, well, I'm going to side with this part of the couple. But really, you know, what really seems applicable here is this idea of, you know, really tuning into our feelings and, you know, looking at ethical challenges as not necessarily the textbook kind of cases that present to you, but that they unfold much more subtly. So this idea of really tuning into what I'm feeling and how I am in the moment in relation to this individual, or in this case, individuals before me, and really just paying attention to the fact that, you know, wait a minute, I may be guiding more than I am listening in this case. Yeah, so there's not an easy answer to that, except that, you know, we just keep coming back to this notion of pay attention. If something doesn't feel right, then maybe your values are getting in the way. Maybe this is a time to take a breath and take a step back and say to the client, let me just kind of figure out where things are.
You know, you mentioned seeing a client at a party. What would be a good way to respond to that? If you both could just kind of, or either of you, kind of give us an idea. I'm sure there are some new counselors who are going to be listening to this who would be like, wow, what would I do if I met a client at a party?
Yeah, you know, Rebecca, I have seen responses across the board to this one. You know, from my own experience as a counselor, to work as a supervisor, to work as a counselor educator, you know, I have found that, you know, when making the assumption that we're working with clients who are pretty high functioning, to be able to process with them after the fact, you know, to be able to, you know, so if you bump into somebody at a party, to respond to it as, you know, hi, it's nice to see you. And then, you know, for me, my personal response would be to say that and to be able to just, you know, politely excuse myself to go talk in another corner of the party or to interact with other folks. And then really making sure that I'm being honest and respecting our counseling relationship and having the opportunity to sit in a counseling session and really address the fact of, okay, so the inevitable has happened. We've seen each other. How do we want to proceed from here? And I, you know, I can think of a case as a supervisor where, you know, I had a supervisee who was horrified because it was a much more intimate social interaction that she had with, you know, with a partner and with, you know, with two other friends, one of whom happened to be her client, and she was horrified by it. And really, you know, we talked it through and we talked about what was challenging for her. And when she met with the client was nonplussed by it and was really able to say, yeah, I told them, you know, you were my counselor and, you know, ha, 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 isn't that great? And how weird that we ran into each other. But it was really important for her as the counselor to be able to sit with the fact that this bothered her in some ways because she really respected the sanctity of that relationship and wanted her client to have her own personal space. I don't know, Holly, you've had some experiences as well.
Well, I think that, you know, as we mentioned before, counselors, you know, we're different people and we work with different kind of clients. So as Dana mentioned, I've taken the same approach, and I also live in a rather small town. And so I take a bit of a different approach just because of the life context I'm in right now. Because I do live in a small town, I make this particular likelihood that we're going to run into each other part of my informed consent. And for me, I talk with my clients that we live in a small town, and what Dana said, I really like that word, just that honoring the sanctity. And it may be more of a value for me than it may be for the client, actually, and that's okay. But and I try to make that a part of my informed consent and explain to clients because I have such respect for your right to keep this private or to explain it however you want to explain our relationship in your life, and I don't even need to be aware of that. I want you to know that if we see each other, I will smile and be a real person, that authentic person comes back again. That's my value. But I'm not going to approach you. I will wait for you to come and approach me, and I will follow your lead. If you're with somebody and you just say, oh, I know Holly, you know, from town or whatever, I will just follow that. But then I want you to know the next time we see each other, let's talk about it. Because I want them to know, too, what may happen, and so that they aren't left with lingering questions after that interaction. And like Dana said, I think for many clients, it's not really a big deal. But for them, as well as the clients for whom it's a big deal, that's what is comfortable for me because of the context where I live and work and some of the clinical issues that I've worked with here. And, of course, that reflects my values as well, and maybe the different values than a client has. But I think circling all the way back around, it's talking about them in a respectful way where I recognize this is my value, but within that professional context, too. This is an appropriate value for me to have as your counselor with the professional responsibility I have. And let's navigate this as it's compatible with your values, too.
Yes, I remember being in a small town and being a counselor and being in a grocery store, and somebody came up to me, Rebecca, hi, how is my relative doing in the sessions with you?
Yeah. And
I was like, oh my God, but I remember saying, let's talk about this the next time you bring the relative in. We'll talk about it then. And thank you, nice to see you. And then I was off, and then I followed it up the next time with, you might be okay with discussing this person's issues, but the person might not be okay. So, explaining it, and she was like, oh, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
Those are difficult situations, but they happen all the time in small towns.
And Rebecca, if you would allow me just to expand one more piece.
Please do.
What you just said triggered. What I have learned, too, is that in a small town, sometimes that can be perceived as rude and that you don't value the client enough to, quote, unquote, remember them. Mm-hmm. And so I think... talk about a value, sort of a disconnect there. There's two values that are very different, but both are important, and there's a reason why people hold them.
Mm-hmm.
And so just circling all the way back, talking about them and having a safe space where we do talk about them, I think that's one of the greatest I hope one of the greatest gifts that we give people as counselors is a space to talk about the taboo, the sacred, the we don't talk about that, and find language and comfort around things that you, the reason oftentimes people come to counseling is because they're talking about things that they can't talk about to the degree or at all in other contexts in their lives. And for us to be able to model that, I think, is so powerful.
Yes, absolutely. Holly, what resources do you recommend to counselors who might want to add some practical tools for addressing values in their professional ethical decision making? What should they add to their professional libraries?
Well, we have referenced in our conversation here some of the ethical decision making models that we find particularly helpful. Not that most of the models don't provide a place for values, but as values become more discussed and more at the forefront of our profession and that intersection between practice and ethics. We list some of those in a bibliography, as you mentioned, that we will provide to the listeners, and they can download that as a PDF, as well as several recent and also some older literature that we think is helpful, not just to the current discussion about how do I practice ethically with values, but that other piece we talked about, understanding the reason why we have ethics and the spirit of them, both the mandatory part as well as the aspirational. And so we'll be happy to share those with folks.
Okay, now we're going to the last question that we always ask, and I'd like you each to answer separately. ACA now has over 55,000 members, most of whom are clinicians. Is there anything I have not asked you that you want our members to know? Let's start with you, Dana.
So there are two things I would say to that. So the first is that it's really important to remember that ethical decision-making is a split-second process. And for that reason, it's so important that counselors really take the time to self-reflect and to really focus in on where they are and what they believe, because we don't have the luxury of saying, you know, when we're faced with a challenge we don't know how to answer, as a counselor to say, hold on one second, let me go find my, you know, really, you know, phenomenal values-based ethics book and, you know, go talk to my supervisor. But to really, really recognize the split-second nature of ethical decision-making and that's how dilemmas often present themselves. The other piece that I would just add is that, you know, there's a parallel to many years ago. It used to be that when we looked at boundary issues in multiple relationships, that counselors were guided to avoid them, to avoid multiple relationships. And we've transitioned to something that is much more realistic, to managing them when they do present. So not if you're faced with multiple relationships, but when you are, how to manage them in practice. And I think that there really is a parallel to ethical decision making as well. It's not this notion of if you're going to run into an ethical challenge, it's when you do, how are you going to do that? And the further parallel that I would take to that brings us back full circle to where Holly and I started and where Holly and I, developed the idea for the book that we put together is that, mm-hmm. you know, it's managing our personal values. It's not if they're going to come into play in counseling. It's they will come into play in counseling.
Right.
And how are we going to manage them so that we're keeping our clients at the forefront of the work that we are doing?
Mm-hmm. I love that. And Holly.
Wow, I think Dana said it quite well. Mm-hmm. And I would just add to what she has said that it isn't a matter of avoiding values. And I think sometimes the discussions and the message that people hear is, well, just avoid it. That's why you mm-hmm. refer. You just mm-hmm. get rid of it. But that mm-hmm. that isn't how the human experience and dynamic unfolds. We
yeah.
bump into each other. We are mm-hmm. a dynamic community. And so the answer isn't to avoid those things. It is to learn how to manage them. And mm-hmm. the point I would make is that in order for us as a profession of counselors to do this well, we're going to have to create safe spaces to talk mm-hmm. about this, where people bring their values, whatever they are, and have a chance to dialogue and to figure this process out. It is not a linear step-by-step process. It's mm-hmm. a dynamic, nuanced process that looks different for different mm-hmm. counselors and different clients. And so I think creating safe spaces and also courage, mm-hmm. bringing courage to those.
Mm-hmm.
I have small children, and one of the lessons we're learning is treating other people the way you would like to be treated.
Yeah.
And I think it's easy for us to do that with clients sometimes,
mm-hmm.
but I think we also need to remember that message with each other within our profession. Those values don't have to be yours, but how would you want to be treated? And let's dialogue. And that requires openness on both,
mm-hmm.
Both people talking to each other. And it takes a lot of courage. So
yeah.
that would be my request to my colleagues and my mm-hmm. profession, that we do that well at our best, and for us to keep doing that, because I think it betters us, and mm-hmm. Certainly it helps our clients.
I love that you brought up courage. And I want to thank you so much, Dr. Dana Heller-Levitt and Dr. Holly Hartwig-Moorhead, for joining us today to discuss values and ethics in counseling. To view links to this program, to write to the presenters or the host, please go to www.counseling.org and click on the podcast page. This is Dr. Rebecca Daniel-Berg, your host for the ACA 2015 podcast series, signing off.